Good afternoon. Is that better? Can people hear me in the back? Yes, we got the thumbs up. All right. I'm Gene Bonventry. On behalf of the Center for Strategic and International Studies, welcome to this late afternoon event. Looks like a pretty good turnout. A lot of familiar faces in the crowd. Before I introduce our two guest speakers today, I want to tell you a little bit about CSIS. Hopefully that's the only acronym that I'll use today. But we'll see. For sure, stop us if we use too many acronyms. Center for Strategic and International Studies got interested in health issues a couple of years ago. Last year stood up a Global Health Policy Center run by Steve Morrison with funding from the Gates Foundation. Steve did several things to look at health, one of which was to form a commission on global health policy to put some recommendations together for the Obama administration on what the U.S. government should do regarding global health. That commission's co-chaired by retired Admiral Bill Fallon and Helene Gayle, who is the CEO of CARE. They've had, they're about to have another meeting this week, I believe. They've had two so far. One of the papers that they presented was measuring the impact of global health engagements as the U.S. government decides what's important in health and what's not. In addition to the commission, but separate from the commission, Steve has also asked myself and Jim Peek, who's a retired Army Surgeon General and former Secretary of Veterans Affairs, to put together a working group to look at the intersection of global health and national security. So I think today's discussion really will feed into both groups. And I see many members of the working group here today. Thank you for coming, gentlemen. I hope this contributes to our work. What we'll do is I'll introduce both of our speakers. Captain Turbush will go first. Both presentations are short enough to be stimulating and should provoke some questions. And some discussion, and we'll have plenty of time available afterwards for discussion. So on my far right is Captain Jim Turbush in his Navy winter uniform.
Let's just tell him real quick. They were going to have me speak first. That's why.
Oh, you're going to have to. Okay. Well, that's right. I'll continue to introduce Captain Turbush, and then we'll introduce you. Captain Turbush is the command surgeon for U.S. Naval Forces Southern Command. So most of you know Southcom, Southern Command. He's the command surgeon for the naval component of that. He's also the command surgeon for the 4th Fleet. And both these gentlemen will tell us a little bit more about the 4th Fleet. You have Captain Turbush and Commander Hartgering's bio, so I'm not going to go into detail other than to point out that Captain Turbush has done private practice. He's worked for the Foreign Service, has a master's degree in public health, and has done a residency in preventive medicine and aerospace medicine. So I can't think of a more varied experience for someone to fill his position. And then on my right, Commander Brad Hartgerink is a special assistant for humanitarian assistance and disaster response in the Navy Bureau of Medicine and Surgery. And his background is in nursing. He's been a nurse anesthetist since 1996. He served aboard the Comfort hospital ship in 2007 when it deployed to Central and South America. And right now he's chair of the Navy Medicine's Humanitarian Assistance and Disaster Response Working Group. So I'll ask him to start off with his presentation. I think he's ready to go.
Good afternoon, everybody. Navy Bureau of Medicine and Surgery is so. BUMED is the central administrative headquarters for the Navy Medical Department, and we're primarily responsible for writing policy that supports the Navy medicine enterprise and also provides guidance to the fleet. BUMED also, we also are heavily engaged, especially now with everything going on in Afghanistan, in sourcing our personnel to all types of missions, whether it's humanitarian or combat roles. So, again, a very busy shop at BUMED. One thing that BUMED does not do, and that is planning humanitarian missions. I can't tell you how many people over the years have said, you know, when they find out what I do, they'll say, well, are you involved in all the planning of the missions, or are you, does BUMED plan the missions? And we don't do that. And as many folks here in the audience know, that the planning happens at the geographic combatant command, by the geographic combatant commanders like CENTCOM and SOUTHCOM, or Southern Command and Southern Command, and also the component commands like 4th Fleet, where Captain Turbush is, and medical department officers only make up a small piece of the overall planning of those missions. So, you know, again, I just want, if you take nothing else out of my lecture, it's that, you know, that the most all the planning occurs at the combatant commander level. And then I just wanted to quickly define the medical stability operations, and that's military and civilian activities conducted across the spectrum from peace to conflict to establish or maintain order in states and regions. Just a little bit of background, so when we get to what we're doing in our working group, you understand why. And the first one is SSTRO, and it stands for Stability, Security, Transition, Reconstruction Operations. And again, I don't want to get caught up in the numbers or anything, but there in 2005, there was an instruction, the DOD 3000.05, and this was really transformative in that it gave it states that the core mission we will be prepared to conduct and support. So, and it would also be given priority comparable to combat operations and addressed and integrated across all activities. So they're looking at throughout the military organization addressing doctrine, organization, training, education, exercises, materiel, leadership, personnel, facilities, and planning. And within these SSTRO operations, medical is only a small piece. So they may be addressing agricultural concerns. They may be addressing the legal system within a particular country, or training police to keep security. So, again, medical is only a small piece of the SSTRO operations. Now, this instruction also states that there will be integrated civilian and military efforts, and that is key to successful stability. And the important part, which I think really gets to, you know, all the folks in the audience today, is that DOD shall be prepared to work with all relevant U.S. departments and agencies, and then foreign governments and security forces, international organizations, U.S. and foreign NGOs, and also the private sector. So just recently, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs came out with a DODD, the 6,000 point little a, and again, this is to address the military health support for the SSTRO. And specifically, they're asking us to organize and equip and train medical personnel to effectively execute these military stability operations. It also ensures that that R&D programs will address MSO capabilities and will also develop measures of effectiveness to develop progress. So this sort of leads us to what we're doing at BUMED. And in April of this year, the Deputy Surgeon General, Admiral Collison, chartered this Navy Medicine Humanitarian Assistance and Disaster Response Working Group. And with this working group, we have four subcommittees. The first is Medical Logistics Subcommittee. And what we're really looking at here is updating the supply list for the hospital ships. What we have found is, these ships have been deployed for combat operations in the past, and so a lot of the supplies and equipment on board these ships is specifically for that purpose. So by what we need to do after being on several of these missions, we've definitely discovered that there are a lot of supplies that need to be added to the supply list that and inventory that will be there throughout the future missions. The next subcommittee is the General Principles of Care, and I believe I saw Dr. Bob Morrow. He's here today, and he is instrumental in getting this subcommittee off the ground. And and what we're looking at accomplishing with this particular subcommittee is producing an overarching policy on principles of care, particularly in an austere environment for humanitarian assistance that deals with ethical care. So that could be, many of the problems that we've seen in the past would be prescribing antihypertensives to patients in a lot of these countries that have no means for follow-up or to get, prescriptions later on. So that's a real problem. And I know Dr. Morrow has reached out to Dr. Gabriel to assist with this. So that's one of the main things we want to address. Obviously, patient follow-up, whether it's, some of these surgeries that take place on board these hospital ships, you never really know. There's no guarantees that everything's going to turn out perfect every time. So when you do get to a case that there needs to be follow-up, we really have to make sure those pieces are in place. So that's another thing we want to address in the instruction. And, credentialing, we on board the Comfort this past time, they had the Dutch had a surgical team, and so we have to, if we're gonna do these missions with other countries, we have to make sure that we've thought out all the credentialing concerns and addressed all the potential problems with that. Patient privacy, again, we're seeing thousands and thousands of patients a day, and we just need to make sure that we're doing things the right way. Patient selection criteria, and also working with non-U.S. providers. And there's many more, but that sort of hits the major ones that we want to address in this particular subcommittee. And then the third committee is education and training. And I think in general, we just need to really refine how we train folks for our missions. And we really need to do a better job at mission-specific training, whether it's on board the Comfort or large deck amphib or whether it's one of those medical embedded training teams in Afghanistan. We really have to train people to do these missions right. And we've recently received some guidance from the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. There's four levels of training, and so we are now in the midst of developing the requirements for each one of those levels, and then the idea is to give it to the services so they can develop their own courses from the requirements that we've already developed. And this is all inter-service. And also we have folks from NGOs participating in addition to other government agencies. So, again, we're really trying to make sure that we address everybody's concerns. And then lastly, we have the evaluations committee. And we're looking at measures of effectiveness and outcome measures. And this is a real hot topic right now. And we're going to have to see where this goes. It's still early on in the process, so I can't really talk too much about the direction we're heading. But I know at this point everything's on the table. But we definitely have to do a much better job of being able to measure the impact that we're making in these countries. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Commander. Always makes you a little nervous when the senior person follows the junior person.
Well, there was method to my madness here. Maybe if I can get a little IT help. Brad started with a disclaimer, so I guess I will too, if I don't fall off the stage, is that we do, in fact, execute missions, and we do planning. What we don't do is policy, but are happy to be guided by those who do, and that's one of the functions of course, BUMED and Assistant Secretary of Defense Health Affairs. I wanted to say hello to Dr. Cassells and Admiral Cullison, who are here, and other distinguished guests. It's a real honor for me to be here at CSIS. I did a little research before coming here today to find out a little bit more about you and a very broad spectrum of people involved in policy, health decisions, and security, with, of course, this international focus. So it's a great pleasure for me to be here. You might be asking yourself, well, what is Fourth Fleet? We are a new command, a relatively new command. We've just been around for a little over a year. Fourth Fleet was one of the many naval commands that existed. Well, it was actually disestablished at the end of World War II, and the region that Fourth Fleet covered is still basically the same region that it does today, which is Central America, the Caribbean, and South America. So we are the maritime Navy component to United States Southern Command. For many of you, this is old hat. For some of you, it might be new. Our commander, our former commander, Admiral Joe Kernan, addressed this group last February. Our new commander, Admiral Vic Guillory, is now, and we are fully engaged with a number of missions in the SOUTHCOM area focus. And I'm going to address just one, unless you ask me questions about the others, and that is Continuing Promise 10, the one that we're planning for currently. Just an overview of the Continuing Promise missions. These are, see if I get that right, HCA missions, humanitarian civil assistance missions, using either the hospital ship, and on this coast it's the Comfort, so the large white 60-foot-high Red Cross, ostensibly 1,000-bed floating hospital, which has performed quite well over the preceding years, and alternating every other year with an amphibious carrier. This is a gray hull. It's a warship. And so it's about 800 feet long, tremendous capabilities, which I'll talk about more later. But in fact, I hope to make the case that in some ways, and for certain parts of the mission, the amphibious carrier is even a better platform for performing some of these humanitarian missions. Now, you see under the purpose there, Continuing Promise 9, for instance, accomplished over 100,000 patient visits and over 1,500 surgeries. So no points off for Comfort, very distinguished record. And these go back now a number of years, this alternating between the hospital ship and the amphib. But the purpose of the Continuing Promise mission, as you can see right up there, is to train. Okay? Now, it's not necessarily to train surgeons to be better surgeons. It's to train in case we, the United States military, are called on short notice to respond to a disaster. That's one of the main missions for our own purposes, is that so that we get better at humanitarian assistance and disaster response. Obviously, lots of other positive spinoffs from that. But fundamentally, we're learning how to respond better to a disaster. And while we're doing that, while we're getting better at what we do, we provide humanitarian assistance to host nation, and then you can see sends a strong message to Latin America: support, commitment, and compassion. And I'm going to try and make this talk as acronym-free as possible, but you can already see a couple of them up there. This is Commander U.S. Navy South. That's us. That's 4th Fleet. And so this is how we do it. And we coordinate the deployment of U.S. Navy, in this case amphibious ships, to conduct CivMil ops that reinforce the Southcom message. And the message is partnership for the Americas. So that's the first bullet that you would take away. The second one you can see there, highlight the word security. And from your own efforts here on global health security, security and health in many cases are synonymous. As health improves, security improves. And then a third bullet down, SME exchange, subject matter experts. And this, I think, is a particularly valuable tool that we can exploit more and more. And these are often mill-to-mill exchanges, peer-to-peer interfaces. That's the level at which they're conducted, where we have things to share, the host nation has things to share. And as a result, we learn some tricks of the trade, but also it builds the host nation capability. We were just in Trinidad, for instance, and had an opportunity to work with some of their military leaders on disaster response. And they are thinking about what they would do from Trinidad to perhaps help some of their less fortunate neighbors who suffered a catastrophe. And then finally, TSC is Theater Security Cooperation Plan, and these are Southcom priorities. And as you can see, part of the effort is also to help build partnerships with countries that we, the United States government, think might be at risk. In state, it's always good to know where you're headed. Security, stability, and cooperative partnerships, anti-U.S. influence and activity are reduced. And finally, as I mentioned, we will get better and become more accomplished at disaster relief missions. And I might add that as we, DOD, become more effective and efficient and better trained to respond to disasters overseas, oh, by the way, we might be better trained and more efficient to respond to disasters in the homeland. So there's some real synergies there, and hope to capitalize on that. So here's the money slide, if you will. This is a scheme of maneuver. Now, there are some changes already in the mix, and some of the locations might very well change. So don't take this to the bank. But the idea being that 8 countries over 4 months, approximately 11 days in each country. The first one that you see there is Mexico. That is still a little iffy at this point and is being worked out between the MIL group, the U.S. Embassy, and the Mexican government. Moving around, we get to Guatemala, Nicaragua, Panama, Colombia, Haiti, and then Guyana and Suriname, which I believe will be a new one, and then back home in November. So four months, quite a few days of steaming, and a significant opportunity to impact health in the region. And the continuing part of continuing promise is that we go back. And for those of you with a public health background, by the way, I am a latecomer to public health. After a career doing a number of other things, I had a chance to go back and get my MPH at UCLA. And there's nothing wrong with UCLA, but got a chance to learn about the importance of public health. And I would have to say, at this point in our planning and in some of our themes, achievable, or I should say enduring, public health outcomes is also a major theme. So we get to go back. Those are the record of the places we visited over the last several years, and then the locations for CP10. Those of you in the military would be disappointed if I didn't show one of these slides. This is the infamous wiring diagram. You can see a lot of dotted line relationships in this. But I will tell you that the relationships not on here are those with our, particularly the interagency partners and the NGO community. At NORTHCOM, we had a saying that it wasn't C2, command and control, but it was a different kind of a C3, which was cooperate, collaborate, communicate. And there's a lot of that going on. So I would say that particularly with regards to these continuing promise missions, there's a lot of the coordinate, collaborate, communicate going on. And in fact, Myself and team members here, we're in Washington, D.C. that week, this week, to do that very thing, meeting with State Department, USAID, Interaction, whom you know, a number of our other partners, in order to talk about continuing promise and work together. Where we get there is not important, but the bottom line, I think, is, which is that these are extremely cost-effective missions. The WASP mission actually is a little bit less than the hospital ship, but nevertheless, both the hospital ship and the amphib, I would say, are extremely cost-effective for the health impact and the strategic communication message that is achieved. And speaking of strategic communications, here's the Southcom plan. And a lot of these are going to sound very, very familiar, but history notwithstanding, well, I guess in terms of history very much, that we do share common interests throughout Latin America, and that, as this group knows quite well, security is a necessary condition for prosperity and lasting democratic institutions. Regional challenges require cooperative solutions, and I would say the most recent H1N1 outbreak emphasizes that. We were in the Caribbean on two occasions in the last year talking about how important it is that we look at this from a regional perspective, and that Southcom is committed to lasting partnerships. Some of the ways that we build those partnerships, interagency integration, and again, that's what we're doing this week. And then next week, we'll have our initial planning conference where we've invited a number of NGOs to Jacksonville, Florida, where we're based, and they will participate in the IPC, the initial planning conference. It's about a year out, and full participation in all of the various meetings are offered, and also partner nation integration. And so in that regard, again, a small team of us, I will be going downrange in the month of December to visit all eight of those countries and work, first of all, with the Mill Group, the U.S. Embassy country team. We'll get out to some of the sites that we hope to visit, and then work with locally based NGOs, and hope to meet with the ministers of health in each of those as well. So that sort of advanced planning on the ground, we'll be working out exactly how the mission will be accomplished. And we're going to be asking some questions along the way, too. And some of those questions include such things as, what are the host nation health priorities? What are the U.S. Embassy and USAID priorities? And how can we promote those enduring health outcomes, what we talked about, the enduring public health outcomes? The focus for many of the new activities will still be accomplishing the surgical procedures, the vaccination, the dental procedures, and so on. All those will be ongoing. But there is likely to be a new emphasis also on training and teaching and some of the ASHORE activities that can go along with building host nation capabilities. So, it was that Einstein said, not all that you can measure matters, and not everything that matters can be measured. In this case, it's important that we measure, and we're pretty good at measuring performance, workload. We're pretty good at being able to count the number of procedures that we've been doing. But there's more to it than that, and I'm not so sure that we've been good at being able to establish, have we had any enduring health impact? And let me just kind of put it from the perspective of USAID, who has been in these countries for years and years and have ongoing programs and have established partnerships, and their good work has continued, obviously. We come in, and for a period of maybe 11 to 12 days, have a big impact, both medically and for the local population, media-wise and so on, and then we leave and we go to the next country. And USAID, for instance, is still there working with the host nation and so on. What we need to do, and this is something that's been talked about a lot, is a firm handshake on the front end with USAID priorities and activities. Our mission is in keeping with what they do, and then a solid turnover as we go so that we have, again, some longer-term impact and we contribute to the greater good. Impacts on attitudes, this is something that has been measured in the past. The Center for Naval Analysis does polling after the Continuing Promise mission and have come up with very favorable results. And in fact, one case, CNA made the link that as a result of the Continuing Promise 09 mission, that actually crime decreased in one of the areas that was visited. And impacts on behavior. Again, those of you from a public health background know that changing health behaviors is extremely difficult, but hopefully we can measure some of that as well. So how do we do it? Here's our tool. The USS Wasp had a chance to see her come into port there in Mayport the other day, 800 feet long, 100 feet wide, big flat deck to hold helicopters, and a huge well deck that can be used to load humanitarian supplies and also for landing craft. And this is really what, in many ways, distinguishes the hospital ship from the amphibious, is that the capability to project ashore, logistics become much easier with the helicopters and with the landing craft. We can operate in a different sort of manner. It's easier to get in close. This makes a big visual impact, whereas the hospital ship might stand off a little ways and not be as obvious to the local population. The Wasp can get in closer. And the CNA study indicated that to have humanitarian assistance coming out of a warship was surprising to local populations and in fact, even had a greater impact. Here's a picture of her. And you can see that the capability there. The CH-46 is perhaps not the helicopter that we'll use. We'll be using larger cargo-carrying helicopters, the CH-53. And, again, a lot of capacity to be able to project ashore. Let me back up one slide. You see there room for 1,800 Marines. Well, we're not going to be carrying Marines, but instead that frees up a lot of bunk space, if you will, for NGO partners, public health service, others, doctors, nurses, other health specialists, and engineers. So this would be more the type of crew that we would be taking with us and not just the uniformed personnel. Deployment objectives, you see these. Again, these are SOUTHCOM-driven, but they're all things that should be, or I'm sure are, of interest to this organization. Ensure the forward defense of the United States, encourage regional partnerships and stability and security, and these are some of the methods that we use to get there. I would say that overall the WASP as a platform has some pretty most NGOs would give anything to have the ability for logistics, security, and communications that a Navy warship like this brings to the fight. So it's a great platform. And these are some of the themes again. Just to put a slightly different theme on it, as we're coming here to meet with people this week, some of the themes or methods that we've put together this week, again, are to work closely with locally based NGOs. Again, the use of CP10 principally or in addition to its other missions as a training platform, train the trainers, build host nation capability, to discover and enhance host nation health priorities, and again, to get the Ministry of Health, USAID, country team, and others to hear about the mission and that we can coordinate and collaborate with them. I would like to stop at that point, and let's go ahead and open up for questions. rather than dig deeper into what the WASP brings to this mission. So, Gene, over to you.
Thank you, Captain Turbush. There are a couple of microphones around that folks in the back have. As you ask a question, I'd ask you to state your name and what organization you you work for, and the floor is open.
Oh, is this working? Okay. I always jump in first. You know, I take advantage of that hesitancy to everybody else is going to say, well, what's going on here? Let me introduce myself. I'm Dr. Larry Casaza. I have my own NGO after years and years of working with World Vision. And another career was Lieutenant Commander with NAMRU 2 in Taiwan and helped to design the detachment, which is now NAMRU 2 in Jakarta. So it's exciting to be here and to get reconnected with what U.S. government and military are doing about these issues. I live in East Africa, and I'm just waiting the day that you're going to start moving around Mombasa and some of these other places that need this kind of intervention that could be so powerful in terms of counteracting what can happen and get off the ground, causing great problems with insurgencies, etc. And at the same time, listening to this, I'm concerned that there's a good balance between top-down and bottom-up involvement. And you've got some NGOs there, but you've got the governments, and you've got USAID, which is often not the best place to go for an understanding of what's happening at the community level. My take is also that I like what you're doing with monitoring and evaluation, because there's another axiom besides Einstein, and that is you get what you measure. And if you're not asking the right questions, you're not going to get the input into what you're going to need to understand about the outputs and why or why not they didn't work. So thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here and to hear what's going on and to offer my services. I'm also Hopkins School of Public Health faculty that is another amazing resource together with NGOs for getting the strategies right. Thank you so much.
Not really a question, but did you have any comments or responses?
Well, sir, thank you for your comments. I didn't catch the name of your NGO. That might be of interest.
It's a very small one, and I did the bottom-up side on the malaria program.
Okay.
I'm fighting the global malaria directions to include communities. ACAM is my organization called African Communities Against Malaria. And if it doesn't happen there, we're not going to get the MDG.
Yes, very good, sir. Well, thank you, and again, thanks for those comments. Just very briefly, measures of effectiveness. We were just over at the Skyline Buildings at the Assistant Secretary of Defense Health Affairs International Health Division, where this group is helping us. We have some, I guess, strategic measures that we're looking at, and the Center for Naval Analysis helps us with that. On a very fundamental level, we can count the things that we do, but it's those intermediate level measures that we're getting some help from the International Health Division there and others. I should say also that during the pre-deployment site survey that we're going around to those eight countries, you're absolutely right. It's important to have the baseline data. Otherwise, you get what you measure. You're right. So getting some baseline data to begin with in order to know what to measure and go from there. So thank you.
Dr. Cassells.
Superb presentation.
Thanks, sir.
I hope people in the audience are aware that you were advancing this cause before all the brass embraced it, and I certainly remember those days, and I think it's wonderful that Admiral Cullison is here. He's heard you give this talk before, I think, and it's obviously a sign of the big Navy support and certainly the Surgeon General to be here. So just a quick question for you. I wasn't sure. I got called out by a page, but are you taking full advantage of the telemedicine capabilities in your planning so that we can get the reach-back consultation, firstly? Secondly, get our shore-based students and doctors excited about the trip, seeing it, you know, on the video? And thirdly, of course, the communication to the world so they see it, so it doesn't get too filtered by some of the local governments. This has been a problem with, you know, some of our other missions, Comfort and Mercy and MIAGAS and previous WASP, just haven't really taken full advantage of some of the Navy's own telemedicine capabilities.
Yes, sir. Thank you. And I feel like I ought to stand up when I address your question. I know of your longstanding interest in IT, and the answer is yes. Just this morning, we were at Interaction and talking with a group who plan to use another IT tool for tracking patient encounters. And it's really very forward-leaning stuff. There are a number of acronyms associated with it. But in the past, a lot of missions have used pen and paper or various other forms to keep track. It's collated, but there are some new technologies that we think could either be incorporated into a handheld. And we know that there needs to be a deliverable back to the host nation, some not just collated data, but individual data necessary for follow-up. I would speak directly to telemedicine two things. One, we were just at Southcom. The Southcom surgeon held a conference where all of the components came together, and Ron Porpatich from TATRIC was there. He was the co-lead for that, and each of the components brought a request, if you will, for a project, a telemedicine project that we hope that TATRIC could support ours. Ours is it's called FACE. It's one that has to do with telemedicine to help facial cosmetic repairs of children and so on. So there's a lot of emphasis on that. I'm not sure we address exactly all of the things that you were concerned about with the Comfort, where, for instance, video teleconferencing and some of the other things. I think we still have challenges in that area, sir, but we're definitely working on it. Thank you.
Go.
Just to add, the surgery department on board Comfort used it this last mission. I do know that. I was talking to the department head of surgery, and he was telling me that they had a lot of great experiences with the telemedicine.
Thank you. I didn't know that, Commander. Probably was great news.
Barry Beck.
Yes, good afternoon. Lieutenant Commander Andy Baldwin. I was a provider on Continuing Promise 2009, and just a couple comments. With the NGO Navy Interaction, I work at BUMED in a capacity as an advocate for Navy medicine. I do a lot with recruiting. It's invaluable, the on the ground, in the field experience that these civilians get to see and what they take back and can share with others. So BZ to that. The more of that we can do, the better. We had roughly 50 pre-med and pre-dental students out there, and I think I could say confidently that we're going to get 10 of them coming into the Navy as Navy docs and Navy dentists. So that's one comment. As far as the WASP and its ability to project forward, that's huge. And we had so many issues with the Comfort and, you know, getting ashore and having to dock or having to drop anchor way offshore. So, and then about the numbers, we'd have comments every night. You know, how many? It's not all about the numbers. It's not all about the numbers, as you smile. And that's true. I know back here in D.C. we really need to have empirical data that we can, you know, really measure the impact we had. But as providers and surgeons and dentists and, you know, optometrists, we all really we couldn't wait for the end of country brief when we could see the heart-touching stories of lives that we were able to impact. And that's really the true impact of what we were able to have in country, and So good balance. And as the gentleman said, effectively measuring that impact. We could dole out as much medication as we wanted to, but I thought that the health education, what we left these people with from a health prevention standpoint, was the most effective. So, sir, I appreciate your comments, and go get them.
Thank you. I believe that Captain Jim Ware had a particularly nice turn of phrase, in that he mentioned that every person that the Mercy touched was a truth point of one, and another way to measure that. So those stories that you mentioned, those heartfelt stories, are still obviously a very important part of what we do. Thank you.
Yes, in the middle.
I'm Dr. Bob Morrow. I'm a currently a contractor working with Battelle in support of Navy medicine. I'm a preventive medicine officer. And I feel like jumping for joy. This is such a great day. I was wondering how you, sir, feel about, now that we're engaged in military and medical stability operations as a national strategy, and there are other nations which are engaged in similar. You mentioned the Dutch. We have our French colleagues here. There are other NGOs. I grew up on the ship Hope, so I'm 50 years associated with Project Hope. And I know that there are many civilian maritime medical missions as well. How do you see your role as now developing with an ongoing military mission interacting with strengthening, leveraging, and working with those other assets for our national security needs?
I'll go ahead and address that. Okay. Well, yes, sir. And in fact, you don't want to talk about future operations, but one of the partner nations that we will be working with, not one of the ones that we'll actually touch this time, but would like to consider sending another platform, a ship alongside, and then another nation that we have talked to would also like to send ship riders with us to go visit some of these places, and also under the idea of disaster, building disaster response capability. So these mil-mil exchanges with partner nations. Now, we distinguish partner nations, those that go with us from host nation that we're visiting, but partner nation capacity and capability building are an important part and are in line, exactly in line with SOUTHCOM priorities and themes.
In front, right here.
Bill Lyerly, Homeland Security Department, but formerly USAID for 14 years, DOD for 28. Anyway, Jim, you mentioned developing a robust measures of effectiveness. You also mentioned Center for Naval Analyses. One of the real challenges we've had in the past in humanitarian assistance operations and even development in austere environments is the whole issue of operations research and being able to work in a platform where you can actually learn from what you do and apply it for future operations. Seems to me you have an opportunity, a target of opportunity here. You said you're going to be working on new technologies from the IT perspective, new procedures, et cetera, et cetera. Is there an opportunity to really, because you're already going to be collecting robust MOEs, to be able to apply that not just to the actual operation, but to actually conduct operations research to see what are some promising practices that perhaps you're running into and that you have a platform where electricity works, running water, and not often do a lot of NGOs have that robust capability for actually doing research, operations, and practical research.
Funny you should ask. We just left a meeting there over at Skyline where, as almost an afterthought, one of the staff members there, Lynn Lowry, whom some of you probably know, offered that there were two graduate students at the Uniformed Services University who were looking at that very thing, which is measures of effectiveness. So the off-the-cuff answer would be that type of research, as I mentioned, we've got a lot of berthing space, and so other things notwithstanding, I guess my requirement back to her was that it needed to be self-funded and they were going to be aboard a long time. So it was something that at least is in the very preliminary stages of talking about that. But, yeah, some research on board the ship while she's underway, particularly on those measures of effectiveness. The thing is, we need to do a lot of that work actually before. What the research may be useful for is the next CP mission in terms of gathering a baseline, determining what the metrics are going to be, and then how we go about collecting it. So their research may not directly impact this mission, but it might very well for future.
Just to follow that up, often the data is collected, but it's then put in a book somewhere and it's not analyzed. So even not aboard ship, if you were to bring it back and then to conduct your studies in such a way that you bring that data back, may engage dozens of researchers potentially.
Yes, sir.
Sure.
Bruno?
Oh. Courtney Scott, Office of Health Affairs, Department of Homeland Security. I've had the privilege to work with a working group here, and one of the questions that we've been wrestling with is when you do these humanitarian assistance missions, sometimes you do it from a motivation of it's just the fundamentally intrinsic right thing to do, and sometimes you do it because you're leveraging your ability to deliver this health care as an instrument for other purposes. And my question to you is, if it's the latter, or if it's perceived to be the latter, or advertised by your adversaries to be the latter, how do you overcome that? How do you turn that into a positive message and communicate that in a way so that you don't look like the ugly American when it's over, said, and done?
Good question. Messaging is terribly important, and this is such a good news story. It would be terrible if there was anything that would detract, but detractors there are. I would say that from a personal example, when I went back to meet my new boss at the time, I was lined up to take this job, and this was Admiral Joe Kernan, now Vice Admiral Joe Kernan, who is a Navy SEAL. And I went in with my head full of a lot of these ideas that you're talking about, which is that we do it to further U.S. interests, and we do it as a strategic communication message, and we're improving security and stability. And all those things are true. Those are all good reasons, and we're improving our own ability to respond to disasters, but I'll go ahead and quote him, and I hope he doesn't mind, but he did kind of the one-finger CPR, and he said, Jim, sometimes we do good things because they're good things, and I remember that, and so I think there's really a case for compassion here. I think we can do it all. I think we can do both the training objective and the strategic communication, and I think that we can do a lot of those things that are in the interests of our ourselves and our partners. But I think we can also do good things because we're a nation of good people and we have big hearts and we do outreach sometimes just because it's a good thing. I don't see those as incompatible at all.
And just to dovetail off that, you know, for somebody, I was on the 2007 mission, and I think when you're a provider or, you know, you're a corpsman or nurse, whatever you are, When you're on the ground and you're providing the care, it's sort of a natural extension of what you do when you're back in the States when you're working in your hospital or whatever. You don't think when you're talking to somebody, you're trying to do the right thing. You're not saying, well, you know, we're trying to, you know, use this as a, you know, for some other political gain. So, I think you can do both at the same time. Is sort of my sense of it too.
Yep, back here in the middle.
Good afternoon. My name is John Andrus. I'm a newly appointed deputy director at the Pan American Health Organization. I'd like to commend you for your efforts, and I'm on a learning curve, so it's exciting to be here and hear about what you're trying to do. In a former life, I worked for the Centers for Disease Control as a vaccinologist, epidemiologist, and I see those examples of successes doing exactly what you're trying to do, maintain security in the region, polio eradication, measles elimination, rubella elimination, where it has that win-win of U.S. support to supporting an activity that's a priority, but also bridges from humanitarian impact to this the security you're mentioning. I was pleased to hear about your training because you've framed the issue quite well in the challenge when you're only there for 11 days and how do you measure your impact. Prior to 6 days ago, I was at the George Washington University where I taught a course, and I think it's important to recognize, I think someone mentioned it, recognizing the difference between process indicators, output indicators, and then outcome, impact, and being realistic about what you can measure. So that was one thought. The other thought was in regards to training, what I see in the field, particularly with immunization services, where you think over the years quality of care would be top-notch, well, we see pockets of services where safe injection practices, for example, are quite poor. And it just it's a continue day-to-day battle to maintain quality of service. And that's an example that I refer to you. But as you teach these young, dedicated professionals, that the quality of care is very, very important. Just search, so I'll stop there. But thanks again, and I appreciate this briefing.
Thank you.
Bueno.
Hello, I'm Commander Bruno Himmler, a public health service officer currently detailed to the Army War College and fellow CP09 alum. A couple of things that we brought out of from the lessons learned from CP09. One was the issue about a lot of the training. We trained on equipment and things like that that the host nation did not have or ability to support. And so one of the thoughts was to say, you know, in 2010 and beyond, would we be able to get donated equipment from hospitals and other things that would be used to train, but then be able to leave it behind with the host nation so they have the equipment that they're being trained on how to use, like for ACLS defibrillators was the prime example. The other key thought, too, get my notes, was that public health and preventive medicine, they've been doing a lot of assessments in many of these communities and seeing that there's issues with drinking water collection and setting up sand filtration systems and holding tanks and things like that, but they've not been equipped with the materials that would be necessary to implement many of their recommendations with the host nations. Is there a thought in 2010 to spend less money on Motrin and those types of medicines and be able to allocate the funding for the engineering projects that they would need, supplies, so they can bring them on board and implement some of the recommendations in 2010? And then my final question is, what is good enough? And I think that's one of the key questions that we look at is we bring in, you know, doctors, nurses, dentists, everybody with U.S. standard of health care to these communities, and we're trying to, you know, impose on them, you know, our standards at times. But, you know, can we decrease the level of expectations that would then allow greater participation of the host nation and partner nations in these activities, you know, specifically dealing with credentialing and privileging and some of these medical legal issues? Thank you.
Three questions while trying to do justice to three answers. The first one you mentioned had to do with donated medical equipment. And, yes, in fact, we had an NGO approach us, Project Cure, that collects and distributes donated medical equipment to a variety of countries. They actually had a need to get things into Haiti, and it just so happens we're going to Haiti. So they sought us out. And with that big well deck, as you might imagine, we can hold a lot of donated medical goods. So this, in this case, it turns out we were a conveyance of convenience, but it turns out I think also there'll be other donated medical equipment going to each of the other countries. That would be the plan. So they certainly got invited to the IPC. Your second question, though, I think speaks to the heart of it. And a little bit of a difficulty is that we in DOD are restricted from reaching out to the NGO community and saying specifically, you do water really well. We would like for you to come with us, or you do maternal child health really, really well. There's a legal impediment in there, and I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to speak to it. But we find out that if there is a brokering organization, such as USAID, for instance, or maybe Interaction, or maybe some other organization that can help us to reach out to the NGO community, of which there's just this universe of opportunities of NGOs that specialize in this or that. And those skill sets then could be brought on board. And so that's the bit of a conundrum that we're in right now, is finding out what's out there and what skill sets they can bring and how can we incorporate them and stay within our legal boundaries. So that's something we're working on right now. And then the third question you ask, I think there's no excuse for poor quality. And I think Dr. Paul Farmer had an expression for that. He said, you know, the poor always get blank. And no, we need to do the right thing. We need to do it in a quality manner. It's first world health care all the way. There's no lesser standard than I know of. So that would be my reply on that.
I also speak to that.
Yeah.
So I understand your concern too. In 2007, pharmacy was the largest. They had the largest budget. So out of everything that we did, whether it was surgery or medicine or whatever, pharmacy had, we spent more money on pharmacy than any other service. So, you know, I think we do have to sort of figure out, you know, what do we want to use pharmacy for? You know, what, you know, and then kind of give some guidelines, because it can get very expensive in a hurry. And you only get so much. I mean, I don't remember exactly the numbers that you put up on the screen, but it was somewhere between $20 and $30 million for a comfort mission. And out of that, I think it's like probably $2 or $3 million for patient care. You know, so you know that all has to be figured out as well. But the pharmacy question is definitely, you know, a lot of times you're giving out vitamins, you're just giving out stuff to anybody, at least in 2007. Maybe things got a little better in 2009. But we, you know, it's one of the areas that we're looking at too.
One of the points that was made with regards to formulary is to find out for sure what the host nation has and what their formulary is, and then try and correspond with that, particularly for follow-up care, that we're not initiating medical care that can't be sustained.
Up front, you had a question here up front first, and then on the side.
Thank you very much for your presentation. My name is Ahmed Mir. I used to be handling science and health policy at the State Department, but retired since then. Clearly, you're doing a job that is much bigger than your team can probably cover. Which are the other countries that have similar efforts, and is there some effort to further encourage countries that have the resources, both in NATO and in Asia and so on, to develop such efforts and work together?
Yes, sir. And in the first week of November, we'll be going down to Brazil for Navy-to-Navy talks. And Brazil, of course, is a very capable partner nation. And I think them as an example, might be able to participate more in future missions.
Pete Chen. I'm a physician. I'm also commanding general for 807 Medical Command, which is a theater medical command for Southcom. My question is, a lot of people going to South, I've been doing this for 2 years now, a lot of people going to South Central America and do a good thing. NGO, you know, Army, Navy, everybody. But it's no synchronized strategy. Everybody going there, everybody doing good thing, but I don't see any impact. I think the key is how are we going to, as you just said, difficult to deal with the NGO, tell them what to do. But at least within DOD, I think the merit and the continued promising should be synchronized at a higher level. And that's number one. Number two, respond to this gentleman's question about a different level of a service, a different level of a healthcare system. I think the key is, I find out, is I visit all the seven priority countries. And a final other question is, in the past, we just send a MedRed medical team going there because of what we think they need. I think the key is we have to ask them, what is your strategic priority? I went to Trinidad. They tell me the number one priority in that country is not really coming to treat a diabetes or hypertension. It's cataract surgery. They have a 7,000 cataract surgery backlog, and they don't have a 23 ophthalmologists, and they really, forever. We send a MedRed team to there for like 20 days. You can only do maximum 200, 250 surgery, and just continue grow. So now we're going to do a concept plan, see if we can do something to help the government to train, to teach local to fish, putting it this way, have a sustained effect. And also try to working with their defense force, starting with a basic life combat saver, and gradually progress it to the EMT level, then slowly graduate up. So I think the key is we got to ask what the local government, their priority. Now we try to match. We're doing good things, but I think just needed to be synchronized somehow.
Yes, sir, very good comments, and I appreciate those. And in fact, it may seem that there is, a lack of strategy. We always are told that we need more, as you mentioned, for eye surgeries, but also more women's health issues and dentists. So we're also told that veterinarians are ever popular. So we need to bring more veterinarians. Those are all things that come, as you mentioned, from the ground up. One of the things we hope to do is to help to determine to a greater extent what the host nation health priorities are, and that's part of that visit. But I will speak to the strategy piece a little bit, and there is a strategy, and there's a national-level strategy, and then as that comes down the food chain, it gets to the geographic combatant commander, and they develop that TSC, the Theater Security Cooperation Plan, and those are the objectives. Those are the themes that, in this case, Southcom puts forward. Pacific Command has another similar set of themes, and then from those we derive missions, and then we go out and accomplish those objectives. So that is kind of the way that strategy flows into eventually to what we do at Fourth Fleet. But I would highlight these are some of the other things that are out there, and there's a whole panoply of different activities that are going on in the Southcom region. It's not just continuing promise, and so the Army and the Air Force have a big plug. MedReadies, as you mentioned, do accomplish a lot. The primary purpose of MedReadies, though, is actually training for DoD personnel. So that is the driver on that. Along the way, we also do some good. But your points are well taken, and host nation health priorities are exceedingly important. Yes, sir.
Yep, right here in the middle.
Thank you very much. My name is Joshua Mark Hughes from Booz Allen Hamilton. I wanted to ask you a question about your training emphasis, and that is that it's very clear what tremendous impact you can have at phase zero. But what insights have these experiences given you for how you would apply medical stabilization operations for the full spectrum of conflict? So looking into the future, are any of the skills that you're training your forces in these missions applicable to semi or non-permissive environments?
You want to address that?
Not entirely. I mean, admittedly, the training piece is something that we really need to get a better handle on. And so I don't think the way we're training for these missions now does address the concerns you're talking about. But I think in a couple of years, when these requirements are identified and we've actually started the training programs, I think we can, we can really help with that. I know the USAID puts on a great course, the Joint Humanitarian Operations course. We continue to train our folks and send them to that. There's DMRTI, Defense Medical Readiness Training Institute, along with our U.S. government partners like USAID in particular. I know I saw Jahan there a couple of weeks ago. there's a medical stability operations course that's being developed that will help with that somewhat, not as much as the joint humanitarian operations course. And then there's out in PACOM, Center of Excellence, that also has some courses. Now, I've heard they want to get out of the education role, but as is right now, there's a chart course and some other courses that can also help. But, you know, I think we're getting better. You know, we're still pretty new at this, the military. So, but over the course of time and as people take more and more of these courses, I think, you know, we'll definitely increase our capability.
Let me make a comment about that, because you're right. For specifically a non-permissive environment, combat arms, maybe these missions are not exactly the very best for teaching and training our healthcare providers to operate in that arena, although they're not bad. But I would say that there is an environment for which they are particularly suited, and the office at NORTHCOM that I had the opportunity to work with did what's called a CBA, capabilities-based analysis of those skills, those man-training-equipped skills, the capabilities needed to do overseas humanitarian assistance and, overseas disaster response and domestic disaster response. And they found with very, very few exceptions that the skill set, the capabilities, the equipment, the training needed for those two missions were almost an exact overlap. So I guess I would make the point that as we get better on these missions, learning how to do disaster response overseas, those same skill sets, that same training, tactics, techniques, and procedures, if you will, can be used in the homeland. So there's a big payoff there. There may indeed be some synergies cost-wise and mission-wise. So I think there is overlap. It may not be combat arms. It may be it may not be that kind of environment. But for domestic disaster response, I think there's a lot of overlap.
Hillary Critchley, working for Dr. Cassells. I have a bit of a background in public global health, so two of the things that have kind of been pounded into me are, firstly, sustainability. So I have two questions about that. Firstly, are there any risks to this program, or does it seem like it's going to be continually appropriated, funded, no problem into the future, you can plan indefinitely? Secondly, when you plan the route, is it something that countries can count on happening every year, every 5 years, every 10 years? Is it a campaign? Do you revisit the same countries, or do you try to kind of spread it around? And is that linked with our kind of State Department global diplomacy goals? And then the second thing that is generally pounded into public health people is, and as has been addressed, it's responding to the needs of the host country. So my background is malaria and waterborne disease, so do you just kind of serve on the kind of first-come, first-served basis, or is there a prioritization of patients according to, you know, what is of most risk to that country's population?
Well, you know, I expected some hard questions from this group, and it had to come from a fellow public healther, so... the sustainability question is one that has been asked before, and in fact, it's even sometimes been asked a little harsher than you, which is that are some of these activities inherently destabilizing? If we go in to a country and provide first world medical care, does it cause the host nation population to think ill of their own government, or does it somehow interfere with the local medical establishment and put them out of business? Those are things that we hope to address during these pre-deployment site surveys. And again, the train-the-trainer approach with an increased emphasis on training to help build host nation capability, I think then that would be a sustainable health outcome. Those would be things that could be measured over a longer period of time. Now, your second question had to do about the route, and do we go back? Yes, continuing promise, that's part of what we do. Now, it's not the same 8 countries every time, but over time, we tend to go back and visit. We don't always visit the same site. And those countries and those sites are picked up kind of to a certain extent by design, a certain extent maybe there might be a little ad hocery in there. But it comes up with a mix between Southcom priorities and host nation priorities, and most importantly also country team priorities. So that, you know, there are a number of people that get to vote in this. The countries chosen themselves, that is something that has been laid out, and that's been a subject of considerable discussion at Southcom. But good points all. The final thing I think you mentioned were the host nation health priorities, and again, that's one of the themes that we hope to really push this time when we go around to the eight countries and find out from the Ministry of Health what are their priorities and how can we work that into the mix. So thank you for that question.
I think another thing that we have to get better at is working with the local NGOs in a particular country. So, and I think that's through USAID. And I think as we get better with working with USAID in these, you know, the country teams, we'll get better at working with local NGOs and taking on the projects that they feel are the most important for that country and trying to piggyback on those as much as we can and sort of go after this with a whole government approach.
And I think there was a question there about State Department's foreign policy goals, too. So how is that relationship going?
We at Fourth Fleet now have a POLAD, a political attaché, and she and I are talking now almost on a daily basis. This Thursday, we're actually going to get to go over to the State Department. We have a separate meeting with USAID, but then to meet with the representatives, the State Department representatives from the various countries. And certainly, I know that there is collaboration, coordination ongoing, but for me, this is a little bit of a new territory, and that's one of the things that we're addressing this week. So I will be smarter at the end of the week.
In the middle, in the back.
Chris Stecker, Office of the Director of National Intelligence. What you guys do does an incredible amount of good. One question I have is you mentioned that one of the impacts you were trying to measure was the public perception of the U.S., public perception of the U.S. military. Do you do your polling or whatever in time series, so that we have an idea of what the half-life is of the impact?
Center of Naval Analysis has been our primary polling arm, and they have gone back into a limited number of countries already that were visited by Continuing Promise 09. And I think you're exactly right. I think that opinion change over time was one of the big lessons that we got out of the tsunami, wasn't it, which is that initial results were quite favorable, but then over time the opinion sort of swung back in the other direction. And that's driven by a lot of different things that are out of our control, to include H5N1, which was one of the considerations there. So I would like to see the opportunity to go back to these countries and do assessments after we have come in with the hospital ship or with the amphibious ship. I think that would be very valuable. And again, repeated visits into the locations to see how things change over time and see if there is enduring benefit from these missions. I think we can see it in the short term. I'd have difficulty proving that over the long term.
All right. Last question.
Thank you. Hi, I'm James Teal. I'm Dr. Cassell's chief of staff, and I was with him in the Pentagon, too, in a public affairs capacity. And I'm going to channel him a little bit here because I know this is something he's talked about before, but are you guys doing any mill-to-mill training when you go to these countries? And if so, what's the extent? I know Dr. Sells talks a lot about how the military in some of these developing countries is often the most stable institution and the most ubiquitous institution in these areas. So having a well-trained military medical facilities within those militaries is very useful.
Well, actually, we have some pretty unique capabilities here in the Courtney Scott is here, former director of the DMRTI, the Defense Medical Readiness Training Institute, and the courses that, of course, come out of DMRTI are fantastic. The opportunity to do mil-mil subject matter expert exchange is something that we look forward to. I did mention the business with the Trinidadians, for whom we hope to do that in the short term. I know that the Comfort Mission did a fair amount of that as well. I think mil-to-mil subject matter expert exchange and training of that sort would be very valuable. And I would say those probably are enduring changes that we could. You know, it's interesting is that as you interact at a certain level, those health leaders in the host nation often become their surgeon general or minister of health at some later stage. So these relationships, which are built early on by these continuing promise missions, may very well bloom at a later date in ways that are unexpected.
In addition to that, in Thailand, there's Cobra Gold, and there's often a MedCap associated with that. So there are some mill-to-mill missions elsewhere in the globe.
Larry, you had a follow-up question?
Yes, thank you. It's a part of what I expounded on that I didn't hear an answer, and that is, where is Africa going to factor in here? And I know you're out there chasing pirates, you know, off the coast of Somalia. It'd be so good to have the ship pull into Durban or Mombasa and perhaps change the tone of what's going on.
Talk about Africa Partnership Station.
Well, I can't talk a whole lot about that.
There's some Center for Disaster and Humanitarian Assistance Medicine out of which is like part of USIS, Uniformed Services University of the Health Science. They're doing a lot with setting up contingency missions throughout Africa for the, you know, in case there's a spread of H1N1. So there is some of that going on. I don't know a whole lot about Africa Partnership Station. I don't have a lot of visibility on that, but there's some going. It's getting bigger.
And there is was a West Africa training cruise as well, but I don't know about the East.
As an invited guest, maybe Colonel Schuyler Geller, who's the AFRICOM surgeon, could come and speak to this group. He'd probably like to come here for a visit, but he'd be able to speak to all of the similar efforts that are going on in the Africa region.
Yep, go ahead.
Just as we got Africa Partnership Station was based in large part.
Africa Partnership Station was based in large part on the success of Mercy and Comfort, and also studied tsunami relief. So I'd say that, at least in the Gulf of Guinea, there's an extensive effort to try to bring some of these benefits to at least that slice of the continent. And whether it can be expanded, you know, on the Horn or other areas, I think is a great question to ask.
All right. Any other questions? If not, I hope you'll join me in thanking our two presenters, Captain James Turbush, Commander Brad Hutter.